its current state on WKAR. Many thanks for joining us. We are Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. And if you're curious about Uber, join us for a ride on Uber and learn how the new Lansing area ride-sharing service works. There's actually quite a bit on the program today involving transportation and housing, and other things all on the way between now and the end of the hour. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us. Just off the MSU campus, demolition crews are preparing to raise the first in a series of buildings to make way for a new multimodal transportation center. The 40-year-old Amtrak depot will eventually come down and be replaced with a larger facility that can handle train, bus, and even taxi traffic. The Capital Area Transportation Authority, or CATA, is overseeing the project through a federal grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation. We're joined today by CATA President and CEO Sandy Dragoo. Welcome to Current State, Sandy.
Well,
nice to see you.
Thank you, Mark. Good to see you.
The demolition of the first building near the Amtrak station is set for today, the old MSU surplus building.
I went by there on my way here, and it is already going.
How convenient.
Yes.
It's just a stone's throw from
it
here,
is.
So you were able to check up on everybody on your way to join us here today.
I didn't want to come in here and then say, well, I think it's going to happen today. It is already begun.
We can verify that.
You can.
What's the timeline on this?
We hope to have it done by fall of 15. Now, that's, you know, we've got to get all those buildings down before we can start building up, so that's what's happened as of this morning.
The project was first announced back in July of
yes.
2012.
Yes. Well, let's hope it isn't going to take as long to get it down and then up as what it has to get it from where it was with announcing that grant back in 12. And normally it wouldn't, but this has been a very complicated project. And, you know, we had the big announcement, and the federal government came in and, you know, gave us the celebration grant check. And
what was the holdup, though?
Well, we had problems with the feds then on releasing the actual money. It's always good to have the big check, but the big check doesn't go to the bank and get cashed until, you know, that we can start drawing down on it. And so that was a problem for a while. And then by the time you get the contracts done, get it bid, and get those things done, then we had to get the architects to draw it, to get it ready. Then that got done, and then the bids came in too high. Then we had to turn around, go back out, rebid it, redraw it, and then rebid it again.
Talk to us about this multiple transportation modes. This is going to be a key feature of,
yes.
of the new building.
Yes.
Will more than CATA buses operate from there? Are other companies involved here?
Yes. We have all the inner city buses, the buses that, you know, go to other cities.
Michigan Flyer,
Greyhound, Indian Trails, those buses that, you know, take people to the other cities. Now, they also go into our station, our transportation center downtown. But, you know, a heavy loads that come out of Michigan State University. And so they will come in there, come off the highway, stop in there, jump back on the highway, and then head on out. So they will be coming in there. And of course, as you had said, the cabs will be going in there. Then there will also, of course, then be the trains. We won't say trains, planes, and automobiles, but you know, those will all be in there, places for bikes. It's that coordinated gateway that we're trying to say, the multimodal gateway, that there will be room for everyone to go to be able to get there and then get on that train or on that inner city bus or on that CATA bus and be able to then go from there and head on out.
Okay. We're talking with Sandy Dragoo, CATA President and CEO, about the new transportation facility, which will be taking shape here over the next year and a half in downtown East East Lansing, I should say, Harrison Road and Trowbridge. Should passengers using Amtrak expect delays during the construction?
No. What we're hoping to do is, what the plan is and what will happen is that the building that's there now will stay there until they can go right into the new building. So, no, we are not planning that that's going to happen at all. We will not demolish that building until the other one is built.
What trends are we seeing involving train ridership here in Michigan?
Oh, going up. We read that Michigan State, not Michigan State, the state of Michigan is saying that train ridership is up. And so we're hoping that this is going to really help here, too, because it's going to be a beautiful station. It will be a station that for the people here, they're going to be able to be very proud of this station. It's going to be a little rough during construction. It's going to be a little rough in terms of parking. When we get done, there's going to be room for 100 cars. But it's going to be a little rough as we're getting those buildings down, as we're going through demolition. But when we're done, it's going to be something that they're going to be very proud of. Michigan State University has been a real partner in it as a soft match. It's on Michigan State University land. Michigan State has given that land. This was a real gift to the project. So it's a joint project with Michigan State University, City of East Lansing, and CATA that went together to get this grant. So it is a partnership with all three of us, and then it's going to be operated by CATA. The grant itself is named to CATA. It's a federal transit grant. So it is a combination of all of us. And so it's going to be a very, very beautiful building.
Will the new station accelerate train ridership even more, just by virtue of the fact that it's a new station?
We very much think it will. We think that if you look at that station, it's not something that we're able to say, oh, gee, we're really proud of this building, because it's not a building to be proud of right now. But it will be when we're done. And so I think for people to say, oh, I'm going to take the train to fill in the blank, or I'm going to go home by riding the train or whatever, it's going to very much be that.
Do you see similar projects taking shape in lower Michigan to this one that might accelerate this trend even more?
In other cities?
Or are we in an unusually good position here with regard to this?
Well, it's going to be very good for us. Now, some of those train stations, as I've taken the train to Chicago, some of those other stations they're ahead of us in some cases, like Battle Creek, Kalamazoo, they have already got nice stations. So, I've heard some people say, well, I'll drive to Battle Creek because I like going to Battle Creek better than I like getting on the train here. Well, that isn't going to happen after we get done. And that's the good part that we can say to people. I think it's another very good step for our region. And as we talk about the things in our region that we're going to have here, this is another good, positive step. And that's what we feel very good about.
Voters just approved a millage renewal to operate the system, $14.7 million in 2016. Uh-huh. What will this go toward?
Well, that is a renewal. And so that's that.
Basic operation.
Basic operation, yep. That was a renewal, but passed by the highest percentage that we've ever had it passed by. So we are very pleased with that. Passed 75% to 25%. So that was the very highest we've ever had it passed by.
Another ongoing project for CATA, Bus Rapid Transit. It'll operate along the Michigan Avenue and Grand River corridor between downtown Lansing and the Meridian Mall.
Yes.
There have been some design charrettes this past spring, public comment sessions. Uh-huh. What's the status now? Where do you see this project?
We are still working through all of the federal steps that it has to have happen. Huge project. It's moving along. Whenever you have a project that is the federal government, it has many, many, many steps. And so you have to take every step before you can go to the next step. So that's where we are. And that's what we're doing. So the board has continued to take, to authorize us to take the very next step. We have a steering committee and we have a technical committee. And so the technical committee, both technical committee and steering committee is made up of persons outside of our CATA board of directors. So that it's the people of the area that are making up those committees. And both of those committees have continued to make recommendations to the board to go ahead, and so that's where we are. So the stations have been approved of where the stations are going to be, how it's going to be built, the lanes that it's going to be. So everything is moving forward.
Sandy Dragoo is president and CEO of CATA, the Capital Area Transportation Authority. Many thanks, Sandy.
You are very welcome. Anytime.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Email us with your ideas, feedback, suggestions, currentstate@wkar.org. Federal officials define housing as affordable when it costs 30% or less of a household's income. By that measure, more than 60,000 families in Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties do not live in affordable housing, according to recent MSU research. Housing advocates say that means tens of thousands of families in and near Lansing routinely are challenged to pay for necessities like food, clothing, medical care, and transportation. So what can be done to increase the quantity and quality of affordable housing in mid-Michigan? Let's learn more from two special guests. Catherine Draper is the executive director of the Greater Lansing Housing Coalition. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Mark.
And Bob Johnson is back. He's the City of Lansing's Director of Planning and Neighborhood Development. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mark.
Catherine, there are, both of you, there are so many factors that relate to housing, that tie into it. In layperson's terms, is there a single thing you would most like to change that would improve this situation?
Yes, I think we'd like to address the fact that we do need more affordable housing for all of our population in the Tri-County area. You know, we've been completing the five-year housing plan, and what we found is what you identified is very true, but there are other issues that also impact that. Our population is changing. You know, we have more seniors coming into housing situations that are not appropriate for them. We need smaller housing situations. We have the millennial population now, and that's a group of people who are interested in being on major transit areas, and they are more interested in renting homes than they are in owning homes. They want to be free to come and go and not be burdened down with housing costs. So
the first thing you mentioned, though, was supply. Is
yes.
supply is, would increasing the number of available units automatically bring down the price then?
Well, I think in many cases we have adequate number of houses and rental properties. It's just that they're not adequately, they're not adequate as it relates to the standards of housing. They're substandard housing conditions, and many people are forced to live in those rather than be homeless.
Bob Johnson, narrow the focus for us down to the City of Lansing here. Is the quality of affordable housing your number one issue, or how would you prioritize the number one
Sure.
issue as you see it?
Right. In terms of the quality of the housing, we have the Code Enforcement Division that's located within the Fire Department to help us with the quality answering that issue in terms of the challenge where people are being taken advantage of and they're put in the position, whether it's not just rental, but also ownership, whether it be under a land contract or whether they're attempting to purchase the house outright and committing their resources to acquire something that really needs a lot of work. So it's already upside down in terms of their ability to live in a household financial situation that they can manage, again, getting back to not exceeding 30% of their household income. It is very important to us in terms of the way in which our neighborhoods are perceived. So when it comes down to little things, it's not just the structures, as Catherine pointed out, in terms of substandard conditions. It's also the environment. What's going on with the infrastructure? What's going on with the light, to include your streetlights, your grass, as far as enforcing the codes on the premises, whether it be grass, trash, front yard parking, things of that nature. So it's very complicated, but the quality of affordable housing is important to what we do in Lansing.
And you would put quality ahead of quantity. Would you argue with a greater number of units available?
I think just like what Catherine pointed out, the units are out there, and quality is to me is above the quantity because the supply is there. In terms of the physical units. Now, the condition of those units is what is at issue here. And you have one way to really maximize profit in terms of, let's look at me as being a landlord, I can maximize my profit margin by what? Deferred maintenance. And that speaks to the quality of those units. And so I increase my return by deferring that maintenance or avoiding any maintenance at all until I'm forced to do so. And that's why, depending upon the number of units, we have either a 2 or 3 year review cycle for rental properties. And again, though, I want to point out it's not just about rental housing. It does get into folks that are looking at purchasing a home as well.
Bob Johnson is the City of Lansing's Director of Planning and Neighborhood Development. We're also joined by Catherine Draper, Executive Director of the Greater Lansing Housing Coalition. Affordable housing is the topic. Catherine, you alluded to our changing population. Everyone is always getting older, but there are more baby boomers relative to other segments of the population, which creates a different dynamic.
Talk to us about that. But, those individuals are also going to be looking for other housing opportunities. They're finding that many of them are housed in large homes. People are transitioning into smaller homes. They want to be in core areas of cities and in even suburban areas. So I see in the future, it's been identified that really people are going to be moving to smaller quarters, and they don't need a lot of the space that they now have. I think they were impacted, by the downturn in the economy, and they recognize the fact that maybe they might have been, underwater on their homes or maybe spending too much of their money on those large homes and decided that it was time to downsize and look for different opportunities.
Bob, what kind, from your point of view in the City of Lansing, what kind of affordable housing is the community most in need of? Is it single family? Is it multifamily?
Both.
Rental?
I would say that we're seeing a trend whereby the affordable housing in the multifamily rental sector, it's sort of where folks can get their start, meaning I can qualify, say, if I'm going through a certain program, which requires income limitations on how much a household can earn. But once I qualify for that housing, I can remain in that housing if there is not an annual recertification. Having said that, what people look to do is move up and pursue the American dream. And the mayor reminds me time and time again, home ownership. I mean, it really is important. And I talk to him about quality affordable housing in the form of rental is okay. And I tell the city council the same thing. Rental, we all were renters at one time. But the segment that probably is most important to attack right now, in my opinion, is that multifamily rental segment, because that's where you have your entry level. That's where people are. That's where they gravitate towards. We talked about the financial crisis and the real estate crash of 08. And people are looking to rent. They're not necessarily looking to purchase. Having said that, there's a number of opportunities out there. There's some really affordable for sale, owner-occupied product out there. folks just have to be very careful in terms of the inspections.
Let's return to the quality issue, though, because you've both claimed that quality affordable housing is an important part of this challenge. How do we address the quality issue, Catherine?
I think we have to get a community involved in that. You know, we have to get the developers involved, the landlords, the renters, bring everyone to the table and develop a framework for how we're going to really address quality housing. And I think people are interested in doing that. We've done a lot of, focus groups and task force meetings with individuals to say, how do we solve some of these issues? And I think there are some models out there that we can use for the future. We can set aside a certain amount of housing and development for, let's say, 10% of that would be focused on affordable housing for low-income people when you're doing a development. We have good examples, Mark, from, I would say, Kalamazoo and Ann Arbor, of trust funds that have been established to address those issues. And I think that some landlord-tenant models might be good. And if we could get a lot of those individuals involved in coming to the table together and saying, what is the standard that we would like to enforce here for individuals? The city does a great job. The inspectors do a great job. I think many of the landlords have their heart in the right place. However, we still have a lot of housing that needs to be addressed, because it's just, it's just not adequate for family situations, especially larger families. We really don't have any resources for like 4-bedroom, 3-bedroom homes. You'll find a lot of 1- and 2-bedroom, mm-hmm. and we provide supportive housing at our facility, and we find that there's a lot of need for larger families to be housed and not too many opportunities for them.
You allude to the future here, though, and Catherine, in a few weeks, you will officially unveil the results of a new 5-year fair and affordable housing plan. It goes by the acronym ICE.
Yes.
For innovative, collaborative, and empowering. Without disclosing too much, I know you want to create a little hoopla here in September for this, but can you tell us about the plan? Can you share something innovative from the ICE framework?
I think some of the innovative things do center around maybe developing a real estate investment trust or increasing the housing trust fund that MSHDA has, whereby you set aside a certain amount of money in all communities for supportive and low-income housing, and not just in pockets, but in areas that are all going to be developed. Providing additional rehab resources, especially for seniors, that's going to be a serious issue in the future. So we're trying to find some resources to help seniors stay in their homes. We have one program at our agency that already does that, but we want to expand that with the help of other agencies. The city helps us with that as well, but, there are other agencies that could be involved. We'd like to get businesses involved in recognizing and identifying the needs for their employees for housing around, their facilities.
How, Bob, how does this play out on the ground? I mean, do you become aware of fairly desperate situations where the adequacy of housing really becomes a crisis for people?
Well, let me say this, that the adequacy of housing, we typically see it when it gets pretty far down the road, when we find out that the housing is inadequate. It's due to a social worker or a co-enforcement worker discovering deplorable conditions. That's typically what happens, because there are good opportunities out there. Now, there are reasons, why an individual or a household may not qualify. There are certain qualifications that have to be met, background checks, things of that nature, that may put them in a challenging position. And I know we're talking about Lansing-centric on this segment here, Mark, but it really is a regional issue, as Catherine's study will speak to. And it's, you think about the service jobs that are, whether it be at one of the major retail centers that are outside of the Lansing city limits, in addition to what
Eastwood or one of the malls.
The malls, exactly. And then the hospitality industry, so on and so forth. Well, you had Mr. Gu on previously in terms of Capital Area Transportation Authority. And so that piece is important, but, folks do drive their own vehicles too. So there are these burdens that challenges of getting to work if you have to depend on, say, a mass transit and then driving your own vehicle. Point is that it's a regional discussion, so I look forward to hearing the perspective of others as well in this when Catherine's report comes out. But the adequacy of the housing, we really try when we do our in review of work through the building and construction codes, our building safety division, we review the work. We know of the work that's coming in, and we ensure we're sort of the, as opposed to the first responders, we're the first preventers in what the work we do, making sure they comply with the code. We work with the fire department, make sure it complies with the fire code, so on and so forth. But then we find out, unfortunately, sometimes afterwards, where there's been a family, a refugee family, let's say, and English is a second language, and they just don't know how to connect to us. Mm-hmm. And when we do find out, it's pretty late, and it's unfortunate.
People are fearful that if they do complain, they're going to be out on the street. Mm-hmm. And so what are their alternatives? I want to address that one issue of transportation, though, because if you're living out in the Charlotte area or St. John's area, you don't have 24-hour transportation.
Right.
So you don't always have access to getting a job within the city of Lansing, and you might not have the job opportunities out in those communities. Mm-hmm. So it's a situation that transportation definitely affects everything in the corridor revitalization as well.
We are eager to learn more about the ICE plan next month when it is released, and we could talk a lot longer, but we're out of time, I'm sorry to say. Catherine Draper is the executive director of the Greater Lansing Housing Coalition. Bob Johnson is the City of Lansing's Director of Planning and Neighborhood Development. Many thanks and good luck.
Thank you so much,
Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Starting in 2017, the state of Minnesota will ban the use of an antibacterial chemical in consumer products. And Melissa Benmark is here to tell us more. What's going on, Melissa?
Well, this is something I'm kind of following right now, and it's definitely kind of in the emerging stages of being a story. But the chemical triclosan, some people say triclosan, has been found in the waters and fish of the Great Lakes, and a number of health organizations in Canada are urging their government to ban the chemical as well. And yesterday there was an article in Bloomberg that looked at the process of how triclosan is considered for use in some brands of toothpaste. It's a fairly complicated article, but I wanted to get some highlights of it. So I spoke to the author, who is Tiffany Carey.
It's been around for a very long time, and it was first in surgical hand scrubs, but it's gotten into, a lot of other products, deodorants, toothpaste, cosmetics. And so there are several concerns. I would say the oldest one is probably the antibacterial resistance. People have been talking about that for longer. But more recently, you see a lot of studies coming out about whether it is an endocrine disruptor. So that involves, affecting the thyroid and the hormone system and all the things that go into that, like fertility and child development. Also, just a really broad range of other concerns that scientists have been looking into, like affecting muscle contraction or muscle function, promoting cancer cell growth. So there's quite a vast range.
So your story in Bloomberg looked at how information about the chemical was handled by the FDA and kind of the interaction between them and Colgate-Palmolive. Kind of give us the setup of what you were trying to find out here.
Sure. Well, I think the story started with a very basic question, which is why is this in toothpaste when it's being taken out of all these other products? And also, Colgate-Palmolive had taken it out of its soaps in 2011, in its antibacterial soaps. So I started looking at how it got into toothpaste in the first place. And, Colgate would often use that on its website and in conversations as a reason that it had this very thorough FDA approval. And so what I found is that, there's a risk-benefit analysis that's done. And when you look at this in soaps and other products, people seem to be finding that the benefit was not so clear. That's one of the reasons the FDA has cited for why it's reviewing its use in hand soaps. But with the Colgate Total toothpaste, it really was documented as part of that 1997 approval and in a bunch of other studies that it's very effective at fighting plaque and gingivitis. So while the risk side remains kind of unclear for both, there's this clear benefit in the toothpaste.
It sounded like the usual thing about having industry pay for studies on itself kind of came into play here somewhat. Can you talk about that?
Well, what we see with the documents that Colgate submitted to the FDA is that, yes, these were all studies that were done either by Colgate or by it seems like the original maker of the chemical, which was a company called Ciba Geigy, and then it became BASF. And there may have been other sponsors of the studies, too. It's not entirely clear. So that obviously raises some questions, although people argue that university scientists have their own motives when they do studies. They're looking for things that are wrong, or they're trying to get tenure and have a controversial result. But when you look at all of these studies, there's definitely a lot of them that show that there are links to potential health problems.
If I understand it right, one of the things that you were looking at was why some of the studies were not made available to the public by the FDA. Is that right?
Yes. So, for over 17 years, these studies weren't available. And there was a public health advocate that had tried to FOIA them. And that's Freedom of Information Act, filed the Freedom of Information Act to try to get a hold of them, and had failed. And so they had brought a lawsuit. And so the FDA agreed to release the documents as part of the lawsuit. And the FDA said it was its own decision to keep them from the public just because there had been a third party who had done some of the studies, and that was their standard policy, that when a third party had been involved, it wouldn't publish these documents.
Why would that be? I mean, I can't.
It's hard to say. Often there's an argument about something being commercially sensitive, that competitors wouldn't be wanted to know that information.
So like industry secrets kind of thing?
Right. A lot of scientists I spoke to said that this kind of information is not typically in that category, though, so it does seem quite strange to several people.
So you did check this with some scientists, and what did they have to say about it?
They pointed out that there seemed to be not a lot of information about how the studies were designed, and that the studies showed some effects that certainly through the lens of today's science would raise a lot of concerns. For example, there were developmental issues in the fetuses of mice and rat pups where the mother had been exposed to triclosan. And the way the studies were reported, they said, well, this is the result of a maternal toxic effect, not a fetotoxic effect, kind of distinguishing that the chemical seemed to be acting on the mother rather than the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists just said, well, that's not a very valid reason to dismiss the issue.
So you're saying that Colgate didn't find that to be a valid argument? I'm not quite following that part.
The dismissal is just very blunt. It just says at the end of the study that this was an effect on the mother, not the fetus, and that's how the study kind of concludes.
Has Colgate-Palmolive responded to the story as of this interview, which I know it's pretty early on here?
Well, they responded to several questions while I was reporting the story. So there's certainly been a dialogue already.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot to say in favor of the chemical being in this toothpaste. Gingivitis and plaque are an issue. I guess periodontal disease can be quite serious. And so, they're saying that compared to the use of this chemical in hand soaps, there's quite a good argument for it to be in toothpaste, and that it does head off a fairly serious health concern that affects a lot of people.
The state of Minnesota recently banned the chemical, and some organizations, health and environmental organizations in Canada, are urging Canada to ban it, too. It's been found pretty significantly in the Great Lakes. Do you think that your story will have any kind of effect on the debate over this chemical?
It's hard to say. I think environmental concerns are almost a whole other range of problems. I didn't get into that very much in the story just because it is a very different issue, but I noticed in my reporting that in response to the FDA's kind of request for public comment on whether or not it should ban this in hand soaps, that there were some people who weighed in from a wastewater treatment agency just saying, this is very much an issue in the environment. In fact, in wastewater treatment plants, it seems to be disrupting the way that normal bacteria process the waste, and suggesting that there could be some problems as the water exits the wastewater treatment plant and the solids from the plant get put back into things like soils.
So what did you see to be some of the legal issues surrounding this story?
That's a difficult question. There are several lawsuits out there about this chemical, triclosan, being in products such as deodorant, where the lawsuits claim that they were sold a product that was supposed to be either natural or supposed to be more effective than other products, and they're saying that was false advertising and they'd like their money back. So there are some class action lawsuits evolving in those areas. I don't think that in the toothpaste we're going to see that kind of legal issue, because it's a very different situation here. No one has said that this doesn't have a clear benefit in toothpaste. And when it comes to the risk side of the analysis, you know, with science, we can see a buildup of studies suggesting reason for concern, but there's no real smoking gun.
All right. Well, Tiffany Carey, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. $1 billion, that's the amount the state could lose, according to the Treasury Department, because of a July ruling by the Michigan Supreme Court. Last Friday, news broke about the court's ruling in a case involving a tax dispute between the Treasury Department and IBM. The court overturned two lower courts and ruled in favor of IBM in its effort to boost the outstate corporation's 2008 tax refund from $1.3 million to $6 million. The decision could lead to recalculated tax refunds for many other out-of-state companies that do business in Michigan, and the total could reach an estimated $1 billion. Here to help us understand what's going on, Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, Rick Pluta. Welcome back, Rick.
Good morning. So Mark, what is it about $1 billion that you don't understand?
A billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon. Talking real money, right? The Supreme Court ended up overturning rulings from both the Court of Claims mm-hmm. and the Court of Appeals. What did the Supreme Court say in the case last month?
Look, put as simply as possible, what happened was a few years ago, do you remember the hated Michigan business tax?
Oh, without
a doubt. That replaced the hated single business tax. When the legislature basically acted to phase out the single business tax in favor of the Michigan business tax, they made some changes that they thought would promote hiring in Michigan, that it would reward Michigan companies that hired in Michigan. And basically what happened was the Supreme Court said, well, you know, you didn't structure it exactly right. And so you thought it was one kind of a tax, but in fact, it's a different kind of a tax. And that tax is actually governed by an interstate compact that says how these are figured out. And so, yeah, instead of about $1 million refund that IBM was looking for, it looked like they were entitled to $6 million. And then it just took a few weeks for the state to sort it out and see, you know, how much similar litigation was out there. And so what the state's liability, you know, might be. And when they did, it was just, you know, the hammer dropped. It was just bang, $1 billion. And so, you know, now there's a little bit of scrambling to try and see what can be done about this.
And the multi-state compact that you refer to, which is really at the heart of this thing, that sought to make it easier to collect taxes from out-of-state corporations, correct?
Right. The idea was that states that joined into it basically agreed to somewhat harmonize their business tax system so that it would be good for the region to attract business. That, you know, if you're operating in the same space, that you're going to be treated similarly as you cross state lines.
Some are saying this could cost the state up to $1 billion in revenue. Will the
some
state
are saying, and when the sum is the state treasury, we kind of have to believe them.
Okay. How compelling a case is that? Will the state actually lose this money?
I would venture a guess not. that right now what's going on is that everyone's waiting to see if the Supreme Court will revisit the decision. There's been a request filed by the state for a rehearing, and that does not happen very often. As a matter of fact, years go by without the court agreeing to reconsider one of its decisions. But I mean, the implications of this one are big, and it was a narrow ruling. It was a one-vote majority, and the majority was actually a concurring opinion by Brian Zara, which means that he didn't join with one side or the other. He wrote an opinion that basically gave one side the win without explicitly agreeing with their logic. And so right now, the state is hoping that there's some wiggle room in there for the court to find a reason to reconsider its decision and come back with something else. But even if the court doesn't, then the legislature is already looking for ways to find a workaround. I mean, the good news is it is a $1 billion hit, but it's one time $1 billion. And you know, Mark, from your own personal finances, that having to give away $1 billion just once is not the same as having to give it away year after year after year.
Michigan's state Supreme Court is the first to rule against its Treasury Department in four out-of-state corporations. We belong to the multi-state compact that we referred to just a minute ago. What implications could this have beyond Michigan?
Many or none at all. That a ruling by the Michigan Supreme Court is certainly not binding on the courts in Illinois and Indiana and Ohio. However, courts do, you know, look to each other to see what logic you use to decide to make a decision. And if the court decides to adopt the law, if other courts decide to adopt the logic that the Michigan Supreme Court adopted, then sure, this could have big implications. But again, at the same time, it's a pretty narrow case. It's a one-time situation based on a series of obtuse tax law changes that were made by the legislature. And quite frankly, I'm pretty confident that if the Supreme Court doesn't reconsider its decision for some reason or another, then the legislature will find a way to deal with it, that we won't be cutting $1 billion.
Rick Pluta is Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, thanks, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
You're tuned to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The ride-sharing service called Uber has been in the Lansing, East Lansing market for a couple of weeks now. Current State Scott Pohl has taken a few rides with Uber, and he's here with more. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Mark. That's right. As a passenger, here's how Uber works. I first had to enroll in their online system, providing information that included my credit card. That's how the fares get paid. I stepped outside our building, opened the Uber app on my smartphone, and summoned a ride. Once a driver accepted the fare, the app showed me his name, Jeremy, complete with his picture, the make and model of his car, including his license plate number, and the app's GPS shows me where he is so I can track how close he's getting. From there, I just hopped in. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for picking me up.
No problem. How are you doing today?
Good, and you?
Good.
I'm talking with you because I'm hoping to learn more about Uber and what's in it for the drivers, perhaps. So can you tell me what motivated you to connect with Uber?
Absolutely. A few weeks ago, I had a friend contact me, and he was out of the Chicago area. And he said Uber was coming live to Lansing. Uber's been around the bigger cities, Chicago, New York, San Fran. But it just came aboard 2 weeks ago here in Lansing. So they guaranteed pay right out of the gates, and basically what's in it for the drivers is every time that they do a fare, they collect 80% of the fare. So on a $20 fare, obviously that'd be $16, and then Uber gets 20% of that fare. So ultimately I'm driving to collect more revenue.
How long have you been driving then? Have you done it the full 2 weeks? How many fares have you had?
Yeah, I've done it 2 weeks. I looked the other day on the dashboard, and I had about 70 destinations that I've taken so far. So on an average, each destination, like I said, it's usually about $10 to $12. But yeah, I've done 70 of them, and this is my first time ever doing any kind of transportation of commuting people at all. So it's a first experience for me also.
So when you applied with Uber, what did they require of you?
They required a few things. First one was a background check. They do that, and that took about three weeks actually. And then the other two things was you have to have the vehicle in your name, and you have to have insurance in your name.
Did you have to get special insurance, or do you need a chauffeur's license?
Nope, they handle all that for you. Basically, as long as I had my insurance cover my vehicle, when I'm working, they actually have insurance that covers me also. It's up to $1 million policy. But as far as for me, I didn't have to get a chauffeur's license or anything extra.
Uber also had some requirements about the sorts of vehicles that their drivers use. What requirements did your vehicle have to meet?
You have to meet a 2004 or newer. Obviously, it's got to be something to where people would feel, safe and that they would feel comfortable in. So, the biggest thing is the riders have to be comfortable when they're getting a request. That's the main thing. And obviously, you got to have them safe. I mean, I shouldn't say it's no different than the cab companies. I've been in some cabs where they're whipping around, but, for the most part, it's a pleasant experience. You know, this is a newer model car, so this is kind of more of a luxury car being a Lexus. But, for the most part, all the cars are pretty much up to code.
If you've had 70 rides, have your experiences for the most part been good, or have you had any bad experiences with fares yet?
I haven't had any bad experiences at all. You get some drunk, rowdy people, but that's just the norm. That's what we do. We try to make sure that the people that are intoxicated or whatever, that they get to where they need to get safe. And it's going to get rowdy from time to time, but for the most part, plus it's a cashless transaction, so we don't exchange any money. I come and pick you up, I see you on the app, and boom, you hop in the car, I take you to your destination, you hop out of the car, you don't have to tip. That's a beautiful thing about Uber. You don't need your wallet, you don't need a credit card, you don't need any cash, you just need your smartphone. You find it on your phone, you hit the button, and somebody's there within minutes, and they take you right where you gotta go.
Now, Uber provided you as a driver with a smartphone that is sort of the receiving end of what I'm doing when I use the app to summon a ride. Tell me about how that works from your perspective as a driver.
Well, so what happens is when you notify that you need a ride, this little device right up here will start to beep, and it goes to the closest person that is an Uber driver. So in other words, if someone else was closer to the radius when you hit it today, they would have taken the ride instead of me. I was the closest, so I hit, when I hit it, I think I was probably 4 or 5 minutes away from you. And then it shows me the direct route right where you're standing when you located it. And then I just come right up alongside you and you hop right on in.
Yeah, that was nice because I could track where you were and it gave me an idea of how close you might be getting to pick me up. So I had some idea of when to start looking for your car.
Yeah, and it's amazing the way everybody that's used it, they say this is all we do is Uber. I mean, only 10% of the population probably know about Uber right now, but it won't stay that way. I mean, I was watching the news yesterday, and it looked like they were trying to put a little negative spin towards it, but it was someone who was involved with the cab company too, and I can understand. They feel like we're taking business from them, and it's not that. It's just the way of the world. You're trying to get the customer the best convenience possible for them. That's what they want. So they have the option. We're not taking business from anybody. We're just giving another alternative solution to what they want.
Are you otherwise employed right now? Is this going to be your only source of income?
Nope.
So this is supplementing your income.
Yeah, what's beautiful about this is at any time I can start or I can stop. If I, like after I'm done with you, I'm going to go to the gym, and then I'll have a workout for about 2 hours. And then once I leave there, I'll probably turn it on, and I got a couple things to do, but I'll just have it on throughout the day. and if people request, then I'll take it from there.
Now, when I take a ride with you, I get an opportunity at the end of the ride to rate you as a driver. And you also get to rate me as a passenger, whether I suppose I was cordial or what other factors there might be in your decision on how to rate me up to 5 stars.
Yep, absolutely. I'm going to pull over and I'm going to show you exactly how this system works. So I'm going to stop the ride and then you're going to be able to see how it looks on our ends.
Okay, I'm going to get out my phone and I'll take care of my end of the transaction too.
Okay. And the only thing they'll ask you for is a rate. So I'm just going to slide to end the trip right here. We're in Frandor. It says loading the fare. I'm going to hit 5 stars. Boom. Good ride, good customer. And then it says it's loading fare. So from where we've been talking, it'd cost you $9.77 basically for that ride right there. No tip. You're just boom. You're in it. That's charging your credit card. And then you're on your way. It's that quick and simple. And so now what'll happen is you have an opportunity, once I submit the rating, it'll give you an opportunity to hit 1 through 5 stars, and then you hit whatever service that you feel like you had.
Well, here's my opportunity to rate you.
Yep.
5 stars. You gave me a 5-star ride, Jeremy.
Ooh, that's what I'm talking about. What's beautiful there is you get to see my picture, so when I'm pulling in, you can kind of put a name with a face. A lot of times I like to call my riders too, just to get that connection, personal connection, bond. And then you got my license plate number, you got my make and model of car. Could be a bad thing or a good thing, I don't know yet, buddy. But you got, you know, I'm saying it's safe basically. You know, Uber's got my information, they got your information, and that's the marriage. And the people typically that are riding with us are anywhere from the ages of 21 to 22, all the way up to 35 to 40. That seems to be the demographic right now of people that might have smartphones and to the cutting edge. And so them are the riders that we're finding, and they just love it. They get in a car, they love it.
Back to the ratings for just a moment. Over the course of time, your rating and my rating will be averaged out. When I summon a ride, I can see the average rating of the driver who's coming. Maybe they only have 2 or 3 stars and I want to cancel the ride. You can do the same thing with me as a passenger. Maybe I've been belligerent with other drivers and I have a poor rating. You might decide not to take my fare.
Absolutely, and it's happened one time so far. I had a guy who had a 3-star rating, and so I went to call him back and he didn't answer the phone. And you know, this is how it works on our end is, we may be at, let's just say we're at the corner of Cedar in Pennsylvania, and I get a request to ride, let's say the airport. So that's about a 10-minute journey. I'm not just gonna drive over to that, especially on a 3-star rating. That means somebody hasn't done following the proper procedures. So if I take the risk and I'm driving all the way over there, then that means I gotta drive all the way back. I've just wasted about 30 minutes of my time. And I've tied up my routes, too, so I'm not making any income.
Well, Jeremy, it's been an enjoyable ride. Thank you.
All right, awesome. Thank you for having me.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
So, Scott, you've taken a few Uber rides now. Are they all as smooth as this one was?
Well, Mark, in a system this new, there are bound to be some kinks to work out. I had one other ride where I was the driver's first fare ever. That means he didn't have a rating from Uber passengers yet for me to consider. When he accepted my fare, it appeared that he wasn't actually in his car, so his arrival took longer than the app had said it would. I talked with him during the ride, so I was clearly distracting him to some extent, but he didn't seem to know how to get where I was going. And at the end of the ride, it turned out that he hadn't ever told the Uber system that he was starting the ride. So he started and stopped it right there. That means the fare was the Uber minimum of $6. Good for me as a passenger, not so good for him.
Interesting. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll preview Lansing's Renegade Theater Festival going on in Old Town this weekend. And for Neighbors in Action, we'll feature Habitat for Humanity in Lansing. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Please join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.